the DSW Black Friday sale is on. Take 30% off almost everything in stores and online right now. Yep, you heard that right. 30% off. Stock up on new shoes, bags, and extras for you and yours from all the gift-worthy brands you love. But hurry, Black Friday can't last forever. Get to your DSW store or DSW.com ASAP to save big. Exclusions apply. Details at DSW.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Every idea starts with a problem. Warby Parker's was simple. Glasses are too expensive. So they set out to change that. By designing glasses in-house and selling directly to customers, they're able to offer prescription eyewear that's expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Warby Parker glasses are made from premium materials like impact-resistant polycarbonate and custom acetate. And they start at just $95, including prescription lenses. Get glasses made from the good stuff. Stop by a Warby Parker store near you.
And welcome, everybody, to today's exciting episode.
Wahoo! It's me, Mario.
I'm the best.
Does he say that?
Yeah, well, he does on Mario Kart.
Oh, yeah, he does. You're right. Yeah, he does say that on Mario Kart.
You've got to remember that. And I can't remember what Toad's one is, but that don't matter.
I was always a Luigi guy.
Were you?
Yeah, I preferred the green to Mario.
I always liked Toad.
Toad was cool. And then they brought out Toadette. And then she was better in the game than Toad was, in my experience,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah. Actually, Yoshi was the best in Mario Kart.
Yoshi was good.
Yeah.
And when I used to play it when I was young, I used to always go for like the smaller characters, like Toad and Toadette and things. And then when I started becoming an older teenager and really getting competitive, I found that the bigger characters, like Bowser and stuff, actually did better because you could ram people off the roads because they were so big and heavy.
Oh, I suppose. Yeah, I always went with the theory that lighter is faster.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well. There you go. That's our Mario Kart knowledge for you.
There we go, yeah. But anyway, today, as you can see, we have a book on the table. It's not a book dive. I'm not going to read it to everybody because this is a new book. It's only been released in the last sort of year. And it is called Dominion Lost by Bruce Rapuano, who has a PhD, who has several degrees. The subtitle is A Scientist's Own Alien Abduction Encounters. And it literally is a book by a man who was a medical scientist for many years, and he kept it, this story, secret all of his life because he didn't want to interrupt his career. He was into like research and that sort of thing. Didn't want to get his funding stopped by the government and that sort of thing. So he kept stum about it. And then recently, he's written this book detailing and outlining all of his experiences with actual alien abductions that happened to him.
Mm. That's very smart because I don't trust the government.
No, nobody trusts the government. Mm-mm. And we've got him here today. He's actually here for an interview. Everybody meet Bruce Rapuano. How are you doing, Bruce?
Guys, great to be with you. Great to meet you, and looking forward to a lively conversation.
That's good to have you on. You are actually our first individual that actually claims to be an alien abductee on the show. So, this is a first for all of us, I guess.
Mm.
I'm in a select group. I think the only people we can think of that are still around, Whitley Strieber, Travis Walton, and one or two others. But there aren't many that have come forward. Mm. I think they will. Yeah, in the next, with this movement for disclosure in the West, I a lot of people are starting to write books now. They're coming forward. So we're going to see in the next year or two. You're probably going to have the opportunity to interview more of us, I imagine.
I hope so.
That's my prediction.
And to sort of... underline your credulity, should we say, you do have several degrees, don't you, in the medical science field. Do you want to outline your experience in that?
So I got my bachelor's degree from the University of Pennsylvania, where I majored in neurobiology and minored in psychology. And then I got a PhD in neuropharmacology, which is the study of the effects of drugs on the brain, at the University of Connecticut. And I was interested in the legal field, and also kind of when I was in the middle of my medical career, biomedical research career, received a JD, a law degree from New York Law School. But for, all of my career, I've been working as a cell biologist in a number of different fields. Started out doing cancer research at the top cancer center in America, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, then focused on cell biology as it related to metabolic bone diseases, worked on developing the next generation of artificial knees, artificial hips. So I studied implant technology, but from the perspective of a cell biologist. So I've published a bunch of papers, and although I do have the legal background, I my passion was in science, medical science. So that was my career.
Yes. Safe to say, a very smart man. And also, credit to you for trying to help with cancer and the whole medical joints. And I really appreciate that. And that makes me like you even more. I think that's great.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Mm. I was from a young age just fascinated with science, particular biology. So, I've often thought about whether or not my experiences with the non-human intelligences have had anything to do with that. Mm. Kind of prompted my curiosity about biology, the function of the brain. I wonder if they had something to do with it, or at least stimulated that interest. Yeah.
Well, mostly just for the people at home listening to this is, we covered that now. Just to say that you are a very down-to-earth man, very intelligent, educated. You've got credit, if you know what I mean. So for you to write this book and to open up about your own personal experiences, I think it makes it sort of extra believable. You know, the fact that you've got this credence to your career, you said in the book, you put it all to one side. You didn't want to come out in the open with it before now because it might impact your career. You've got that. Are you retired now? Are you, Bruce? Or
well, very close to the end of my career. Yes.
Okay,
So I, early on, when in the 80s, I was just starting my career. Had a postdoctoral fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. That was the time when all these great abduction books came out by Bud Hopkins, Dr. John Mack, the Harvard psychiatrist, David Jacobs, and Whitley Strieber. Just a couple of years later, came out with his first book, Communion. And I was reading these books, and I'm thinking, this is just amazing. I not only did I believe all these accounts of hundreds and thousands of abductees that were interviewed by these great investigators, but I had to conclude their stories were believable and what happened to them happened to me. And, I could have written a book, but I decided that that if I did so, I probably would not be able to get funding and be able to continue my career as a medical research scientist. But, now at the end of my career at a time when it seems there's this call to action, momentum for disclosure, I don't know what's going to come of it. But here in America, we're talking a lot about disclosure from the government and our military about what they know. And I thought this was a perfect time for me to release my book.
Oh, it definitely
write and release my book.
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, like you say, there's a lot going on in the States at the moment with the whistleblowers and it being brought to Congress and that sort of thing. We can't hide behind it anymore, can we? It's got to come out in the open sooner or later. And that's one of the things that you said about in your book, is that these stories need to be told, need to get out there. So should we start by telling your story? I mean, it starts off with you as a very little boy, doesn't it? Back in the 1960s. And
yes.
Do you want to tell us about the first encounter that you remember?
what's interesting about this is because I had this experience 2 months before the first reported abduction account in America, which was the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This was in September of 1961. They were traveling, I think, in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. They were coming back from vacation in Montreal. And my experience was in the same year, but a couple months earlier. Late June or late July. I was 6 years old. It was a beautiful summer night, lying in bed, just around dusk time. And I'm about to nod off to sleep, and I'm attracted by a glint of light, reflection of off of something I can see outside my window.
Must have been swamp gas.
Very cool. I talk about that. Talk about that in the book. It was definitely not swamp gas because I could see an object.
Yeah.
It was the strangest looking airplane I'd ever seen, flying just over the rooftops of the apartment buildings in our neighborhood, maybe 5 or 6 blocks away from where I was. And I thought it looked very strange because the fuselage looked more rounded, less tubular, which I thought was strange. It was also had a highly reflective surface. It was still, glinting in the waning sunlight. I thought I saw wings, but no sound. And ordinarily, I would have been so fascinated to look at this object, unlike anything I'd ever seen before. I wouldn't wanted to take my eyes off it, but I did something very strange. I, as if under command, turned my head away from the window, put my head back on the pillow, and immediately fell asleep. Very uncharacteristic for a curious child of 6 years old. Now, when I woke up, I wasn't in my bedroom anymore. I wasn't in my bed. I was on a table that was clearly, felt hard to the touch. I didn't know what the material was, but it was clearly way too long and too wide to be a table for a six-year-old child.
Yeah.
And my sense is I'm in a hospital. I think I'm in some type of clinical environment. I don't know how I got there. And I'm attracted by some commotion, maybe 20 feet from the foot of this table. And I sit up and I can't believe what I'm seeing in front of me. I'm seeing dozens of 3.5 to 4 foot tall humanoid beings. I know they're no taller than I am, with classic gray alien anatomical features.
Yeah.
The disproportionately large hairless head. But white in color, almost pure white. Dozens of them are walking from right to left, and dozens walking from left to right. And I immediately seemed to form the impression that they're doctors. They're the strangest looking doctors I've ever seen. I think one thing that had occurred to me was that they were maybe military doctors, but I'm sitting up, and now I'm starting to interact with the beings I'm seeing. I'm attempting to interact with them because, frankly, I'm indignant. I don't know why I'm here. Who brought me here? For what purpose did they bring me here? So, as I said, I had sat up, and I immediately point at the beings in front of me and shout at them by saying, "Hey," I know they're doctors, but I say, "Hey, you're not my doctors."
Mm.
Well, this is probably not a good idea because by calling attention to myself, I think I attracted another being because I felt a hand, what was like a hand on my body. It was as large or larger than my chest and abdomen combined. So I have this sense it was the hand of a being that was probably taller than the beings I was seeing in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt something like a hand gently pushing me back down on the table. And for some strange reason, I had no urge whatsoever to resist. Mm. I had no willpower to oppose. Obviously, I wanted to find out what was going on with me, but I just let myself be pushed back down on the table and was rendered unconscious. And that's the last I remember of this event, which, as I emphasized before, I began talking about it, happened before any of this was in the popular culture anywhere in the world. There was no talk on the television, in the movies, no books that had come out about abduction that described anything like the beings I had seen. in 1961, in summer of 1961.
Yeah.
So that's why, and not only that, it's preceded by a couple months, the first documented case of alien abduction of Betty and Barney Hill.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's a particularly interesting story and one of the more interesting narratives of abduction that I have in my book.
Ah, so was it almost like a trance then when you went back down on the table? Was it?
No, Josh. It was immediate. That's the last thing I remembered, and I was somehow rendered unconscious.
Wow. Just from like kind of the touches, like you said, like a command in a way, where there might have been
some type of neurological command by some mechanism that they used to render me unconscious. Mm-hmm. Maybe something they could activate remotely, or I talk a lot about in the book is one of the functions of these implants that abductees remember, maybe to not only study the function of the human brain, but to manipulate human thinking, human mental activity, human consciousness. So, I might have had an implant at that time.
Yeah.
That was one of the functions might be to control me. But for some reason, whatever they used to control me was powerful enough that I didn't have the will to resist it and immediately went to sleep.
Wow. So can I ask you, these implants and things, are they still on you today, or did you have them removed, and what were they like?
That's the most common question. And all I can remember is at that same age of 6 years old, I had a memory, like a flashback memory, of a 2 millimeter diameter silver color ball, a sphere with would look like it had studs or projections on the surface of it, like a thimble that you would use for sewing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And also, along with that, this emotional grounding in another memory, which was that I was told that I had to be careful. It could come out if I sneezed too forcefully or blew my nose too hard, which is the reason why I knew it was a nasal implant, because this associated memory, marked it as something that had been inserted into my nose. And I had the childish concern that I was going to get in trouble if it came out, perhaps like it had come out before. Mm. Now, I never had any medical condition that required me to have imaging of the brain, a CT scan or an MRI. So I can't confirm whether or not I still have an implant. I can't rule it out, but I can't prove that I still have one.
Yeah.
It's possible that, it was used to I think part of the program involving the earliest generations of abductees might have focused on studying the function of the human brain, and so the implants might have played a role in this particular experimentation at this stage of the abduction program. After that, there may be no need to have the implant, and I'm imagining that for many abductees it might have been removed when the program progressed to the next stage.
Wasn't there a chapter in your book where you I think you blow your nose, or you had a nosebleed or something, and then you were
diagnosed,
and there was some scarring up inside your nose where potentially that implant had been like inserted?
Yes, it's very commonly reported by abductees who can remember having an implant, particularly a nasal implant. Almost all of them can remember having episodes of unexplained nosebleeds. It's often associated, as in my case, with a period of missing time. In my case, it was the same age of 6 years old when I was in the hallway of our apartment all alone. I didn't know what had happened to me that day. And gosh, all of a sudden I felt wet under each nostril. And I heard a message, a voice inside my head, which I knew was not my voice, telling me, don't let them see the blood. I didn't even know I was bleeding.
The holidays are coming, and everything's aglow. Give your loved one a reason to sparkle with jewelry from Blue Nile. Right now, Blue Nile is offering special Black Friday and Cyber Monday deals. Save up to 50% on the season's most stunning trends. Or keep it classic with an endless selection of bold gold styles, gemstone jewelry, and eternally stylish diamond pieces. Shop now for up to 50% off jewelry at BlueNile.com, the original online jeweler. That's BlueNile.com, BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here for, I guess, my 100th Mint commercial. No. I mean, honestly, when I started this, I thought I'd only have to do like 4 of these. I mean, it's unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. How are there still people paying 2 or 3 times that much? I'm sorry, I shouldn't be victim blaming here. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch. Whenever you're ready.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
That's why, you know, I'm convinced this was not my voice. Sure enough, I walk or run several steps to the bathroom. I'm horrified to see I've had a trail of blood from each nostril that's reached my chin. I quickly wash off the blood because coincidentally, my family, specifically my mother and younger brother, were just walking to the apartment. So it was almost as if I was told to or ordered to or instructed to remove the evidence before somebody discovered it. This is at least the unexplained nosebleed, as I said, is very common among abductees who could remember these nasal implants along with their other abduction experiences. Not only that, there's a particular case of a family in Indiana where there were multiple generations affected by this abduction. A phenomenon that can remember multiple abductions. And at the same age of 6 years old, a child in this family had was examined by two physicians, an ER physician and an ear, nose, and throat physician. Both of them found a scar in this child that had a nasal implant, was abducted by reported seeing small humanoid beings, and had an unexplained nosebleed. Both doctors found a scar in the back of the throat behind the nasal cavity, which actually the surgeon had said was the most difficult part of the medical procedure that they was performing on the child, which was to remove the adenoids and tonsils. I had the same exact experience. Not only remembering the implant, not only having the unexplained nosebleed, but when I had my adenoids and tonsils removed at the same age of 6 years old, the ear, nose, and throat surgeon found the scar, which he related to my father, asking him if he knew if his son had done something to himself, put something up his nose to cause this scarring. So this, I thought this was so peculiar that there was an abductee in a family that was affected by this multi-generational aspect of this abduction phenomenon that had the same set of experiences that I had. And I should say that beyond, you know, my case and this particular case in Indiana, there are dozens or more of abductees that report these nasal implants and even more that report the unexplained nosebleeds among abductees that can recall being taken into UFOs and had some type of experimentation performed on them.
Yeah. I mean, the scar on the nose just doesn't appear from nowhere. So something must have happened.
I had to have an intervention.
Yes.
Some type of intervention, some type of medical or pseudo-medical procedure had to have taken place for there to be a scar there.
And I'm not to make light on what your experience and what had happened, but it's nice to know that over the years, you keep hearing about being probed in the butt. And it's actually nice to know that the aliens aren't doing that to people. Like, I imagine a nasal passage, it makes more sense.
More sense. There's a higher purpose to it. They want to access your brain.
Yeah, it's closer to your brain. So that would always make sense. So I've never understood when it was TV shows and movies and things, why they always say about aliens probing. It makes more sense to have something close to the brain as to what you're saying. So
very good point, Josh. It's a very good point. Also, I have to say, maybe I'm reading the wrong books. Read hundreds of books about UFOs. I don't know if I've read maybe even one case where of anal probing. I've read accounts of hundreds and thousands of abductees, 10 to 20% of which provide evidence of some type of implant, usually in the head, either inside the ear canal, behind the ear, under the eye, or in the nasal cavity.
Yeah,
I don't know if I can even recall one account of nasal probing. You know, that perhaps I didn't read that particular book by that particular investigator. So it leads me to believe maybe this is something that just came out spontaneously on television in the popular culture.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'd heard of the ear canals as well, and like implants behind the ear is something I've heard about as well when it comes to alien abductions as well.
Yeah, well, Bruce, in the book, you actually go into what you think these implants are doing. You go into like magnetic signals, like directed magnetic fields to directly access specific areas of the neural networks to try and either manipulate or map your thoughts and process that and transmit it to these alien beings. And you go very, very in depth in how you think that these things happen. I mean, the kind of technology that could put that seriously high intensity magnetic field into such a small area of the brain via such a small implant, like you say, they're only like a couple of millimeters across. That is technology that is far advanced from anything that we've got. Even just being able to directly manipulate magnetic fields in that precise a way, we'd need a piece of equipment that was the size of a room to do that, wouldn't we?
Exactly, and you explained the essence of those chapters very, very well, Pyro. But look at what Elon Musk is doing with Neuralink, and what he is done with primates, and now he's starting to do it with human beings.
Yeah,
involves the placement of not only dozens but sometimes hundreds of electrodes throughout the brain. So it's really stunning to imagine a technology where an advanced alien civilization with a single implant, and I talk about how this hypothetically could occur, could essentially have the capability of playing the human mind like a piano from one small device. Now we have devices that can measure with a very high degree of sensitivity the very minute magnetic fields produced by sources in the brain in a very small area, but to be able to target multiple areas of the brain and really catalog human mental activities and perceptions and emotional experiences would require human scientists, as I say, to use dozens, if not hundreds, of devices, which, of course, as you can imagine, would have potentially very serious side effects.
And you'd need the kind of processing power that we could only imagine, like supercomputers or even quantum computers that we're just starting to develop, that you would need that kind of processing power to even to be able to determine those signals, individually assess what each area of the brain is doing and what it's doing and how to then project that information back to wherever it's being received, wouldn't you?
As a non-computer scientist, as I wrote in the book, I can't imagine having that much computational power in such a small device, which is the one I remember that other abductees remember as being only a couple millimeters in diameter, just a tiny little ball. And I have no reason, there is not much evidence that anything more than one implant was used for each abductee. So this is why I imagine that this has to be technology so sophisticated that I don't think we're going to be able to duplicate it within the next generation or two or more.
Definitely not. Definitely not. I don't know. Are you familiar with a documentary? It used to be on Netflix. I'm not sure if it is anymore. It was by Jeremy Corbell. I think it was called Patient 17. And that was about a man who claimed to be abducted. And he had several implants through his body. And they were removed, medically removed, and assessed. And they sent them off for analysis. And these implants came back with isotopic values for the minerals and the metals that were involved. These isotopic values were not found here on Earth. The way that those metals were produced were by a star creating them that was not in this part of the galaxy. Mm. I mean, perhaps that's the kind of technology that we'd need to even begin that kind of computational physics and whatnot.
Yes, but the other point I would make, along with the point you just made, is that that's kind of a smoking gun. And not only that, in science we look at, if we have an observation that's as remarkable as that one, you need to be able to replicate it before you believe it. And I think there are, at present, there have been multiple scientific investigations, probably several at this point, in addition to the one that was referred to in the Corbell documentary, that have had to come to the same conclusion, that there's some something about the elemental composition, the isotopic ratios, and materials that were analyzed in those particular implants by multiple scientists and working at different laboratories throughout the U.S. That cannot be duplicated, that we're not that cannot be manufactured here on this planet. So to me, that represents a type of smoking gun, that there is an advanced technology here. And
absolutely, like you say, we can't manufacture those alloys, those compounds here, because they're made naturally by supernova stars. You know, that's naturally how these minerals and compounds are created in the universe. You can't just go into a laboratory and then recreate aluminium with a different isotopic ratio. Yeah,
right. Or make aluminum that's 99.9% pure aluminum, which no metallurgist can synthesize, but yet they found these materials. Yeah. So where did they come from?
Yeah.
They didn't come from our planet.
No, definitely not. Like iridium. Iridium is here on the planet. There's just one single layer of it going around the planet that was brought here by a meteorite. Iridium isn't naturally from our solar system. You know, it's come here from somewhere else. All right, that has happened naturally, but you know, there must be somewhere out there in the galaxy where iridium is formed naturally. Well, it's not here. You know, we can't go and just synthesize it. It's a natural occurring compound, but it occurs somewhere else. So, yeah, for these implants to contain those kind of isotopes, it has to come from off this world.
Mm.
Yeah. And that, this is, as a scientist, this is what I'm hoping for, is that there will be centers of research. You know, we have a couple in the U.S. Headed by Dr. Avi Loeb, the astrophysicist at Harvard, Dr. Gary Nolan, the immunologist who has a team that's doing a lot of interesting neuroscience studies on abduction experiencers, remote viewers. And you know, it's part of my dream is that we'll have enough scientists and funding to be able to study not only the external structure, but the internal structure of some of these implants, which may ultimately prove that they were manufactured and they represent some type of technology. We're not quite there yet, since we haven't had, the degree of acceptance by the scientific community, so that very many scientists at all are interested in even beginning to study this. But I hope that changes.
Can I ask you a question, Bruce?
Yes, Josh.
So, do you think in some way your abduction led you to who you are today and helped with your research and was kind of like the reason? Like, was there a part of you that wanted to go down this path?
Yeah, did that set you on your path in life and sort of reaffirm what direction you wanted to take with medical science?
I have to say that the memory I have that leads me to believe that's exactly what happened is gosh, within months of having one particular abduction experience where I woke up in the middle of night, I think it was 12 or 13 years old. And I was somehow, I sat up out of a sound sleep, was automatically completely alert and had the sense that I was going to make contact with something that transcended normal human experience. And I was induced, coerced, I now realize, to leave my bedroom in the middle of the night, walk across the street to a neighbor's yard where I had an encounter. And within a few months of that, for some reason, I became interested in the field, which was a kind of a burgeoning field at that time in the 60s, of extrasensory perception. Began reading, as a 13-year-old, reading everything I could about ESP, to the point where one of my teachers allowed me to lecture to the class about the subject. And that leads me to believe that's why I became so fascinated with the function of the brain, and why a few years later I decided to study neuroscience, to major in neurobiology, and actually obtained an advanced degree in it. And I wonder if this is all part of some grand plan. If perhaps I was somehow induced to or pushed in a direction to become interested in a field that would allow me to write a book about alien abduction. Okay. So, you know, I like to think that, you know, that the alien beings abducted me would support some type of disclosure, that perhaps I'm playing some role in it, but I don't know this for a fact. And I suspect that's just wishful thinking on my part, because a lot of what the ETs or aliens or interdimensionals, whatever you want to call them, do involves a lot of deception and a lot of subterfuge, and they try to hide the evidence of the work they're doing by erasing the memories of the abductees and trying to cover up what they're doing as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a big question, because obviously I've read your book and read through all of your theories on whether they're controlling our mind or whether they're leaving us with the free will and just monitoring us or what. Now, do you believe, because this isn't necessarily clear, do you believe that these alien beings are benevolent in a way, or do you think they are sort of looking to take over our planet and get rid of us, or do you think they're here to help us?
Well, as a scientist, I'm open to either hypothesis, and I discuss both of those hypotheses in the book. Now, you know, I really wonder if they're doing something for our benefit. You know, why they have to take such great pains to cover up the program. Mm. So on the other hand, there's a third possibility. You know, they may feel compelled to divulge as little as possible about what is happening to human beings, to the subject of their experiment, so as not interfere with the scientific experiment. And the third theory is that they may just have a pure scientific interest in studying us. They're just scientists that study Homo sapiens the way human scientists study a variety of animal species, so that we can learn more about ourselves and perhaps learn more about physiology and biochemistry, with the ultimate goal of being able to treat diseases that we don't currently have therapies before. So their interest may be purely clinical, or they, as I discuss at length in the book, they may, particularly by using these implants, want to learn as much they can about the functioning of the human brain to be able to control us, so that they can not only utilize the natural resources of the planet, but utilize Homo sapiens as a natural resource, whether or not we'd be recruited into some intergalactic conflict, or simply be used as a as a worker species, like I think the greys are.
Yeah.
That I think the beings I saw are not the master alien species, but are under the control of a higher order alien species that might have actually created this species from early hominins here on Earth. Which leads me to believe that maybe this is one of the theories, only one theory. Maybe we're going to go down that same path and have the same fate as the, as I call them in the book, the poor gray aliens have. Have had to go down.
Become drones for
some drones or robots
or order that we're not even aware of. So, do you think that possibly the master race, if you like, do you think they're sort of an emotionless race, perhaps? You know, purely scientific, purely in it for the study, and you know, that's their higher. The reason why they're higher beings is because they're not governed by their emotions. They're more intellectual, or you know. I mean, what's your theory on that one?
Yes, I think that's my working hypothesis. I'm just trying to think back to accounts, and they're very few and far between of abductees that try to relate to the. Either the short gray alien or the taller gray aliens that are their captors by asking them questions. And you know, there are occasions where there seems to be some type of, through telepathy, of course, some human exchange between the alien and the human being, where they ask questions are answered. The aliens try to allay their fears and calm them down. You know, this is something that, it's a general approach I've used in working with animals, with laboratory animals, with rodents and rabbits. You try to, in any way you can, relate to them, feed them, pet the animal. It's all part of this grooming to so that they become more willing and compatible subjects for your experiment.
I guess that's a good analogy. As scientists here, like you say, working on mice and lab rats or whatever, we are an emotional species. We care for these animals, but animals don't know that. You know, from their point of view, we are like a higher being. They don't know that we're actually caring for them, or you know, through our studies trying to help them. That they just see us as some giant being that's doing whatever it's doing, and yeah, like you say, that they learn to. To operate within the parameters that we want them to operate in, by you know food, you know encouragement or something like that. Maybe the aliens are trying to do similar things with us, but obviously their intentions are beyond any scope that we can even imagine.
Yeah, so maybe it's just an expediency. That's in order for them to carry out the experiment that they need to be able to calm us down but on the other hand, there have been interactions between the aliens and ETs where the ETs talk a lot about, you know, frankly, what they claim our species has done to the planet. They tell us you're killing the planet.
Yeah.
You know, and they show them images of areas of the planet 50 years ago and then what they look like today and what they're going to look like 10, 15, 20 years from now. So I don't know if this is part of a benevolent agenda, or it's part of their deception to make us think that they're here for our particular benefit. But you know, I'm the type of person who's an optimist, but I think we should plan for the worst, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. So, you know, I would like to think that the aliens are that the main goal of their program is to alter human evolution, to accelerate our evolution so we can perhaps get along better with ourselves and then be acceptable as members of the, you know, the advanced civilizations of our particular area of the cosmos.
Okay,
that, you know, that's my hope.
That's a good theory, because obviously, you know, in the last, even just the last couple of hundred years, we've been through like the Industrial Revolution. Now we're in like the Technological Revolution. Humans have evolved to a point where we can't just go back to like hunter-gatherer of simple farmer types. We are going to progress. We are always going to advance. And I guess the only way that they can sort of encourage us or control us is to encourage that, but in a certain direction. Is it, do you think that's correct?
Well, along those lines, Pirate, you know, they know, my God, they know all the pitfalls, and they may be aware of, you know, who knows, thousands of civilizations that were at the point we're at, because they may be millions of years ahead of us. We don't know.
Well, yeah,
but then we understand that it's more likely than not that you're going to reach a tipping point at which, like the one we're at now, where 90% or 95% of the time civilizations reach a certain level of technological advancement and then extinguish themselves.
Oh yeah, the great filter, yeah.
Yeah, and they may be trying to get in our heads, altering the human genome and maybe the human neurophysiology, so that we can evolve to a point where we can see the light, and maybe we can find a way of coming together as a species and seeing the commonality, you know, that we all have as human beings, so we can avoid destroying ourselves.
Do you think like humans need to reach like utopia and all get along before that can kind of happen?
Like as an end goal?
Yeah.
Or just to survive.
Mm.
We're going to need that just to survive as a species. And then of course, once we do that, then there are myriad of opportunities once the human race comes together for and how we could advance technologically and hopefully, you know, culturally and spiritually as well. But, you know, I'm primarily concerned about, you know, what is going to do in the human race over the next 25 years.
Mm.
An advanced civilization or multiple advanced civilizations or us. And if they're here for our benefit, maybe they're going to hopefully save us, at least in the short term, save us from ourselves.
Yeah.
And then hopefully we can get some aid and knowledge from them to move to closer to a utopia.
That's a beautiful way of putting it.
It is, yeah. I think that's a good point to bring it to a close. We've been going for 45 minutes now. Thank you very much, Bruce. I highly recommend this book. I recommend that people go out and buy it. Probably the abridged version is more suitable for most people, because I bought the unabridged version. There's a lot of science in this. And we are going to do another special little episode for the Patreons, where we're going to dive into it's only going to be a short one, but we're going to dive into some of the science that Bruce has sort of uncovered and thought up for himself. But I definitely recommend people go out and buy this book. It is very much of an eye-opener. Thank you for coming on today, Bruce. We will be talking to you again very shortly for the extra episode. But yeah, it's been a real experience talking to a man who's very open about the idea of abductions and where it's taken us as a species. I think you've got some very interesting theories there.
Mm.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you. We had a very enjoyable conversation.
Yeah,
speaking with both of you.
I've learned a lot today, so it's nice.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And for those who are interested, on Patreon, there will be another short episode where we dive into some of the science behind the book, like the Great Northeastern Blackout in America that happened across Canada and the Northeastern Seaboard. Bruce has got some theories on that. He's got some theories on the gravity drive that I want to go into. So if you're interested in that, I know some people will be, go and check us out on Patreon. It will be a free episode. It won't be paid for on Patreon. It will be free, so anybody can go and download that and listen to it. And we hope you do. And until next week, I've been Pirate.
I'm Josh.
Bruce, would you like to say hello? Say goodbye.
Have good evening, everyone, and hope to see you all as we watch the skies together.
That's nice.
Lovely. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. This has been Paranormality UK. Ta-ta.
Ta-ta.
When the energy is high and the music is right, pushing past your limits becomes that much easier. Take a reggaeton run or strength class on the Peloton tread, and you'll quickly see why these are the workouts you've been searching for. Every day brings new challenges from expert coaches who train and speak the same language as you do. Level up your workouts with Peloton Tread. Find your push, find your power. Peloton. Visit onepeloton.com.
Oh my God, it's the coolest thing ever. Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? Well, check this out. It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. They ship Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. Seriously. So if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT.
This is a mini meditation guided by Bombas. Repeat after me. I'm comfy. Comfy. I'm cozy. Cozy. I have zero blisters on my toes. Blisters. And that's because I wear Bombas, the softest socks, underwear, and t-shirts that give back. One purchased equals one donated. Now go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST at checkout.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.